Well, welcome to Adventist Forum. Those of you who braved the weather, our program today is E Pluribus Unum, for whom, for us, for the gods, for neither, for both, and presented by Dr. John Jones from La Sierra. As we begin our time together, John Baldwin is going to offer a word of prayer.
Heavenly Father, we're thankful that we can take some time to come together here at Andrews University. We're glad that John can be with us. And we pray that the Holy Spirit again will be in our presence. And we thank you for the discussions we'll have and for the concepts presented. And may we uplift your name to your glory. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Yeah, I thought I'd share a few stanzas with you from a poem which I thought might be appropriate for our considering our discussion today of various religions of the world. It's by Sophia Lynn Foss, who was a religious educator of the last century. Her poem's entitled, It Matters What We Believe. Some beliefs are like walled gardens. They encourage exclusiveness and the feeling of being especially privileged. Other beliefs are expansive and lead the way into wider and deeper sympathies. Some beliefs are like shadows, clouding children's days with fears of unknown calamities. Others are like sunshine, blessing children with the warmth of happiness. Some beliefs are divisive, separating the saved from the unsaved, friends from enemies. Other beliefs are bonds in a world community where sincere differences beautify the pattern. Well, we do have are planning a forum next month, March 10. We've had some complications in our scheduling, and so the topic may be different than what we had announced. We may have to swap a couple speakers, but we're still waiting for confirmation. So we invite you back next month and watch your email to find out what you're coming to. And speaking of email, we do have sheets in the back. If you're not getting notices and would like to, you can sign up there. And also, we appreciate Jim Harris's efforts to make recordings and get them up on the web for us. And so if you have somebody asking about a presentation that they missed or whatever, you can refer them to our website, Michiana Adventist Forum, and they can download audio from many of our past presentations. Our speaker today is Dr. John Jones. He's coming to us from La Sierra University, where he's Associate Professor of New Testament Studies and World Religions. He asked me to keep the introduction short, so I've dropped off the last couple of three pages of the bio. But I will mention that he's a third-generation Adventist who was raised over in the Philippines, where his parents were on the faculty of Pacific Union College, so he's been in what did I say? Philippine. Did I say Pacific?
Yeah.
Oh, well, okay. Philippine Union College. He did graduate from Walla Walla, and he and his wife here from Andrews, and then went out to Napa, California, where she was working in nursing, and he in pastoral work. They then went to Hong Kong Adventist College, try if I can get these colleges right here, from here on in, where for 5 years he was chair of the theology department, and Pat established and administered the School of Nursing. They then went to Vanderbilt University for doctorates and returned to Asia in 1978, where John taught at the Far Eastern Division's Theological Seminary for 9 years. Since 1987, he's been associated with La Sierra and Loma Linda Universities. He served as dean of the School of Religion from 1990 up until about 4 years ago when he returned to full-time teaching. And his areas of particular expertise are New Testament studies and Asian religions. Well, with that, we'll say welcome. We're glad you're here. We'll leave off the other things that we found from smokinggun.com and let you take over.
Oh, dear. Thank you for that. Yes, thank you. Well, having been raised in Asia, the custom is to applaud right back at you, and with a genuine salute. What a wonderful thing to see a thriving chapter of the forum here. That is just great, and Pat and I are just so tickled to be back here. There's so many memories of the way things were when we were here before. The weather comports with our entire memory of our full 3 years here when we were here before. the canceled air hop over last night to South Bend from O'Hare, some things never change, you know, they just stay the same. But both of us look back on this chapter in our lives when we were here, newlyweds, as some of the most interesting, intense, growth-filled moments in our lives. When I left here, I went to one of my professors and said, I hope I have the good sense and inner wisdom to not indulge in writing an autobiography when I come to the end of my days, but if I do, I don't know what it'll contain, but I know what the opening sentence will be. I was born in Berrien Springs, Michigan, at the age of 23, and I still feel that way today. Every time administrative duties or business over the intervening years, it brought me back to this campus. Without exception, I've never missed the opportunity, I may miss it this time, to sit down in the chapel of Seminary Hall and reflect for 15 or 20 minutes on the lives and ministry influence and vision of those whose ministry has impacted so many, hundreds and now thousands, and impacted me so strongly and powerfully. I am so grateful for those on whose shoulders I and the colleagues of my era stand. And we are, in some sense, epigonoi. We come along behind. And if at some points we may find ourselves seeing a little further than some of those great visionaries did, it's only because we stand on their shoulders. It is a joy and a pleasure for Pat and me both to return to this place that has been so formative in both of our lives. Thank you for the invitation. Yeah, what did we say? E pluribus unum, something about for whom, huh? For us or for the gods or for all of us or... An alternative title might be, Do You Believe in Evolution? You would have expected that from me, right? Coming as I do from La Sierra, I didn't want to disappoint you, so I have to put it in there. But really, as we reflected together with your forum officers about how best to spend this time together, we considered four or five different possibilities, but finally, it came out that a recording of something that I had done now a few years back in San Diego on world religions in North America seemed like the most promising and attractive idea. But that, I must say, at that time, now some years back, was little more than a kind of a breathless, all too breathless recounting of what's changing in our society today. With world religions represented increasingly. And you don't really need me to tell you about that. You, even in this corner of the state, you are fully aware by now of the shifts of demographic, population, and religious shifts that we're undergoing in this society. Now, of course, the various religious traditions of the world, while scattered across our map, primarily form parentheses, you know, on the east and west coast of the United States. And here in the central part, primarily Detroit, especially with reference to our Muslim friends, and Chicago. So you are well aware of that, but you know, even here in our local area, You have only to go as far as South Bend to find one Hindu temple, two Buddhist temples or centers, a couple of mosques, four synagogues, one Baha'i house of worship. Over here in Benton Harbor, another synagogue, Mishawaka, a Sikh Gurudwar, and if you go to Kalamazoo, you can add a half dozen more to the list. So it's not only the urban and municipal areas, but right across the countryside now, a new phenomenon in the growing diversity and the word is more than diversity, it's pluralism now. The melting pot of American society and culture, which has worked so well to assimilate people from so many different backgrounds, is now beginning to look more and more like a tossed salad or something of the sort. You understand the issue. And that raises new ways of seeing and being for all of us. We the people. Who are we, the people? Well, we are Christian primarily still, by far. About probably 9 or 10% of our population openly and regularly profess some faith tradition other than Christianity. Maybe not quite 10, maybe about 9% by latest figures across the land. Internationally, of course, Christianity still leads. Nationally, Christianity, the largest group is Roman Catholic, and then followed by Lutherans, Methodists, Catholic, Baptist, you would expect that, and then Methodists and Lutherans. Around the world, Christians are pushing 2 billion, 1,970,000,000, something like that. Second most populous religious group is Muslim, 1,200,000,000, like that. Of Hindus, 770 million. That's rounding it off a bit. Buddhists, 357 million. And then the list goes down with Sikhs worldwide, 23 million. Jews, about 15 or 16 million worldwide now. Confucians, that is very difficult to count anymore. We just hardly know how to tally this. People who are explicitly outspoken and self-identify as Confucians would be something like 5 million, but that's outside of China, where in some sense everybody is nominally Confucian, yes, even in this post-Maoist era, although Confucius has been largely vilified and there have been repeated attempts to stamp out the influence of his thinking. Jains, 4 million, Zoroastrians, 480,000, and the list goes on, as you would imagine. Here in the United States, Jews are, let's go with Muslims first of all. Muslims here in the U.S., the latest figures now, are about 6 million. CARE, the Council of American and Islamic Relations, which is perhaps as close as anything of an overarching group here in America, says 6.2 million. That's about the most accurate figure we can get. Practicing self-identifying. Certainly down where I live in the Inland Empire, an hour east of greater LA, we find that Muslims are very much present. There's a large and important masjid or mosque in Riverside, and it is spinning off smaller ones now. It serves a community of something over 2,000. It's largely Sunni, although it does serve Shia as well. Jews are right at about the same point, about 6 million. So Now this gets interesting because Jews and Muslims now are just about at parity with each other in the society, which is a way of saying in the electorate. And wait till your local congressperson finds out about that. They don't quite get it yet, but they will. And all of a sudden, they're going to start seeing things in a little different light, perhaps, than they have traditionally. So that is certainly a dynamic force. If we take Hindus here in North America, they are something like about 60, about, I had that in my head and got here without it, about, I don't want to say, I'm sorry, I don't remember quickly, clearly. I'll see if I can still come up with this for us here. But they are certainly, oh yes, here it is, I do have it, 1.5 million now, yeah, which is surprising. They're growing very rapidly. Sikhs, of course, are populous in our country as well. Buddhists are about 4 million now, just under 4 million. And almost equally divided between immigrant groups and converts, people who are coming out of Christianity or whatever else in our society. About 47 or 48% of that nearly 4 million are converts in this country now. A little over 50% are people who are hereditary Buddhists coming in from outside. So clearly, the ground is shifting under our feet. This has happened. The real turning point there, as many of you are aware, 1965, the Immigration and Naturalization Act. When Jack and Bobby Kennedy were working with helping our society cope with the civil rights issues, it became increasingly clear to them that this was not merely a matter of African-American participation in society, but of other groups as well, against whom we have had a long history of discrimination. Congressional actions to that effect, I will not take time this afternoon to walk you through all of that. It is not a very edifying history. But that act was actually signed into law in 1965 by President Lyndon Johnson on the 4th of July up at the Statue of Liberty, actually. He, knowing how to, like a good politician, how to stage things, he succeeded well. That turned the corner in the patterns of immigration and civilization, of settlement and religion in our country. And the result is that from that day to this, we've seen a sharp and increasingly pronounced diversity moving toward plurality, pluralism in our society. Now, that has triggered all kind of responses, as you can imagine, across the pattern. We still have remnants of the old exclusivism that has been part of our consciousness. Others tend more toward the model of assimilation, but even assimilation, when the pace quickens as it has in our society, no longer can keep pace, because what you begin to get is enclaves of people who settle in groups, and then you begin to get not only linguistic communities, that language, the question of language is always the cutting edge for this as to whether people genuinely seek to assimilate or not, as you know, but now increasingly toward actual diversity and beyond that toward pluralism, which we'll say a little more about a little later. There has been some backlash. Peter Brimelow, in his book Alien Nation, writes, there is no precedent in history, yeah? There is no precedent for a sovereign country undergoing such a rapid and radical transformation of its ethnic character in the entire history of the world. Interesting. He is quite outspoken about this, which he signals all of the problems and issues for it. But the result then is that we find ourselves now confronted in new ways, particularly at this moment of economic hardship. across our land, and especially, well, down where I am in California, but also across the central parts of the country. It's one thing to put up with one another of different views when the economic tide lifts all boats. But in a point of diminishing resources, or at least severely limited, a point of unemployment, rampant hardship genuinely in this country, then it's easy to start scapegoating. And I am particularly concerned with some of the advanced signals that I begin to see down where I live in California of genuine ethnic and religious resentment, which I think is driven in some degree by this feeling that we are now engaged in a new game, a zero-sum game, in which we cannot all kind of make it together. The distribution, of course, is not only geographic, but also can be traced in terms of professions. As you know, many of the immigrants who do come into our country and contribute to our society are highly educated people. Ernie Bursey, whom many of you know, who is down at the Health Sciences Institution down in Orlando, has written in one chapter of a very interesting book. The book is edited by three Loma Linda faculty, Siroj Sarajakul and Mark Carr and Julius Nam, entitled World Religions for Healthcare Professionals. World Religions for Healthcare Professionals. And Ernie, writing the opening chapter for that, states that we clearly, within the areas of engineering, and he's dealing with healthcare, so he's particularly also targeting that one. He says that in 1994, out of 120 medical schools that were accredited offering degrees and courses in medicine and spirituality, these are the ones offering coursework in medicine and spirituality, those 126, 17 of them had that particular focus, that combination, medicine and spirituality. By 2004, the number had risen to 84 schools out of the 126, and it continues to climb today. That signals a change of consciousness within the medical profession. He writes that nearly all of my graduate nursing students report working alongside nurses or physicians who openly hold to a faith other than their own, whatever that might be. He mentions, in fact, the dedication of a new temple, a Hindu temple in Florida in 2005. The souvenir program itemized the names of the donors. 77 named donors contribute. These are the people contributing 10,000 or more each. Of those 77, 42 were listed as doctor or doctors, indicating that both husband and wife were medical physicians. Out of the 77, 42 were so listed. Hindus, we know, have moved to the fore in the practice of medicine and of health sciences generally. So educational levels are reflected in this as well. That has, obviously, as you know, that has to do something with Department of Immigration policies, screening for those who will make the most contribution to our society, but it also reflects the attitudes of the people who come here additionally. So in all of that then, we find ourselves confronted with a new contour of our society and ways in which to deal with this. Now, that in and of itself is of interest, but I want, rather than spending more time documenting all of this, which is what I had simply done in San Diego, to try to somehow pick up a conversation now with you, to try to set forth, and then maybe we can reflect together a bit, on some of the of the philosophical and yes, theological questions that lurk behind all of this without getting all heavy this afternoon. After all, you find out who your true friends really are when you see who turns out on a snowy Sabbath afternoon like this when it's so much more comfortable to sit home by the fire. But let's see what we can make out of this. And here comes then the question behind the questions. E pluribus unum. Does that apply to us? Or when it comes to religion, does it apply to the gods too? Or to God? How shall we read this? And how shall we understand? The question circles around a particular set of work now that's emerging among scholars of religion, kicked off, really, by Carl Jaspers, a historical philosopher who lived through the last century, or largely through the last century, who has noted what we've all noted in a way, but who in his writings began to pull it together in new terms that have caught fire around the world and in our society of scholars today. Namely, that the world religions, the great leading world religions as we know them and recognize them still today, all stem from a particular period that led up to the time of Christ. Let us say the 800 years or so leading up to the time of Christ, or nearly to the time of Christ. There have been various nuanced work on this, but about that period. For example, let me just share with you quickly from Karen Armstrong, who in her book, The Great Transformation, picks up on Carl Jaspers' suggestion. She says, I believe that we can find inspiration in the period that Carl Jaspers called the Axial Age, Achtzenzeit, the axial period or the turning point time, something like that, yeah? Because it was pivotal to the spiritual development of all of humanity from about 900 to about 200 before the Common Era, and others draw a little different brackets around that. In several different regions, the great world traditions that have continued to nourish humanity came into being. She picks up four of them in particular. Confucianism and Taoism in China, yeah. In India, both Hinduism and Buddhism, each in their own separate directions and developments. Monotheism in Israel, yeah, and philosophical rationalism in Greece. She says this was the period of the Buddha, Socrates, Confucius, Jeremiah, the mystics of the Upanishads, Mencius, and Euripides, and others. It was a period of intense creativity. That is certainly true. That at least is true. A time when spiritual and philosophical geniuses pioneered an entirely new kind of human experience. The Axial Age was one of the most seminal periods of intellectual, psychological, philosophical, and religious change in recorded history. And she goes on to say there would really be nothing comparable to that until the Great Western Transformation, which created our own scientific and technological modernity. Even so, she says, still today, we have never surpassed the insights of the Axial Age. In times of spiritual and social crisis, men and women have constantly turned back to this period and its thinkers for guidance. They may interpret the Axial Age discoveries differently, but we've never succeeded in going beyond them. Isn't that interesting? Yeah. Here is then where the intriguing aspect of all of this really takes off and raises for us a particular set of questions that have a tendency to morph into all kinds of issues, but we'll try to stay focused on a particular way of asking the question this afternoon. And indeed, it may raise for us the big E word after all. Is there the possibility, indeed, of a kind of evolution spiritually of the human race? perhaps of the sort that we are already familiar with in the scriptures, Old Testament, and moving into the New, of shifts of perspective, different understandings of God and what is expected of us. I'll come back to that in a moment in more detail. But if that is indeed the case, and I'm not presupposing that this afternoon, this is still work in progress, and I'm, along with others, I'm still very much engaged in trying to step back and rethink it. So this is not a pre-cooked thing this afternoon. Neither do I mean to insult you by giving it to you too raw. So somewhere between the raw and the totally cooked, I invite you to think with me for a while this afternoon. Let's move then from the known to the unknown, starting with what is quite familiar with us, to us, namely the question of the Jewish prophets, the great classical prophets. This is not new to us. We're familiar with Amos, whom we might date somewhere in the mid-700s, something like that. Where with regard to ritual, particularly, the Almighty has some stringent words to speak in their hearing. Amos chapter 5, beginning in verse 21. I despise your religious observances, your festivals. Your assemblies are a stench to me. Even though you bring me burnt offerings and grain offerings, I will not accept them. Though you bring choice fellowship offerings, I have no regard for them. This is the New International Version. Away with the noise of your songs. I will not listen to the music of your stringed instruments, your harps. Rather, and you know how it goes, let justice roll on like a river and righteousness like a never-failing stream. A shift, a clear shift. This comes to the Hebrew community as news that God is stepping back from the ceremonial and demanding something different, having more to do with the ethical. Micah, latter half of the 700s, you know it. With what shall I come before the Lord? This happens to be his chapter 6, beginning of verse 6. How shall I bow down before the exalted God? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings and calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams? 10,000 rivers of olive oil? Shall I offer my firstborn for my transgression? The fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? And then again, the prophet turns the corner and says, he's shown you. He has shown you, O mortal, what is good and what it is the Lord requires of you. Just this, act justly, love mercy, walk humbly with your God. Isaiah, of course, 58. Shout aloud, do not hold back. Raise your voice like a trumpet. You know how this goes. The people cry out to God and say, why is it? We keep your Sabbath. We observe the ceremonies. We respect the rituals and participate in them faithfully. Why don't you hear us? Why don't you respond? We have fasted and you haven't seen it. We've humbled ourselves. You haven't noticed. And then comes the indictment. On the day of your fasting, you do whatever you want to do and you're exploiting all of your workers, quarreling, strife. You can't fast as you do today and expect to hear your voice to be heard on high. Is this the kind of fast I've chosen for you? Only a day for people to humble themselves? Only bowing one's head down like a broken reed or lying in sackcloth and ashes? Is this what you call a fast, a day acceptable to the Lord? Here's what I've chosen, verse 6. Do this. Loose the chains of injustice. Untie the cords of the yoke. Set the oppressed free. Break every yoke. Share your food with the hungry. Provide shelter to the wanderer. Clothe the naked. Yeah? Not to turn away, even from your own flesh and blood. Then your light will shine forth like the dawn. And it goes on, you know, that exalted language about the Sabbath. Yeah? Call it a delight, and I, the Lord, will cause you to ride in triumph on the heights of the land, and so forth. In other words, the rituals have meaning only in the context of a higher moral vision and a greater ethical sensitivity to one another. It's just that simple. Sabbath, yeah, only works in the context of a larger meaning. Last book of the Hebrew Scriptures, God speaks to the priests and says, you turn up your nose, you sniff at my temple and its offerings. You complain that it smells, in other words, like a slaughterhouse. Yeah. I will no longer accept any offerings from your hand, the Lord says. Malachi chapter 1, verse 10. I'm through with it. I'm not going to accept any more of this. Yeah? Pretty stringent. We find here also, alongside this, a new sense of emergent grace. God is depicted as one, as a God of loving kindness, one who reaches out, yes, even to the alien, we would call the undocumented aliens. Think about that. The concept of divine grace, which is reinforced, of course, in Jesus' own proclamations of grace, reaching back, however, to Zechariah, who stands before the Lord dressed in filthy clothes. This is chapter 3. The angel removes the filthy clothes and on behalf of the everlasting Lord says to Joshua, I have taken away your sin. I will now put fine garments upon you. Grace, forgiveness, acceptance from on high. Clean turban on his head and so forth. More to say, but you're familiar with it. Interestingly enough, our first intimations, really, of the Golden Rule, which we find already back in Leviticus, really, in our mental model of the Old Testament, we tend to work from the books that appear first in the Old Testament down to those at the end. In actuality, the Levitical injunctions appear to have at least arisen in written form somewhere about the time of the Babylonian captivity or directly thereafter. So, you know, you can choose a date between 550 and 400 B.C. Here is where the Levitical injunctions really take form, at least in their written versions. You shall not take a vengeance or bear a grudge against your kinfolk. Love your neighbor as yourself. There it is. I am the Lord. This verse represents one of several versions of the Golden Rule, which itself appears in various forms, positive and negative, in the rabbinic texts and the Hebraic texts. The stranger who resides among you shall be to you as one of your citizens. You shall love him as yourself, even as you were once strangers in the land of Egypt. Yeah. And you all know the famous story of Hillel, who repeats the Golden Rule in negative form, but it's the same thing, negative or positive, it's the same principle. The ability to identify with the other and treat the other as we would want to be treated and not treat the other as we would not want to be treated, yes, emerging clearly. Now, if we take these principles then, the issue of the role of ritual and how ceremony functions in a particular religion, and put alongside it the question of the sense of self in relationship to the other, and combine those issues together, and the question of ethical behavior and morality, we find here a matrix. It's only a part of a much larger and more complex one, but at least those three issues, which we can now trace across what's going on in other societies of the world in the same general time period. And that's what has sparked all of the conversation among the scholars. They have come to new recognition of this dynamic. Moving quickly to Hinduism, just very briefly, this axial age is the period of time when you have a shift from the Vedas, the very, very ancient text, among the very earliest that we have of sacred texts anywhere, which are almost nothing beyond liturgical formulas, ritual and ritual and ritual. That's basically all they amount to. Great technical details of the what type of ladle you should use in the fire sacrifice and ceremony, which was their central one. The Vedas come during this all predates the axial age. The Vedas come to be replaced during this very period in the centuries of the run-up to about the time of Christ or so, starting maybe 800, 900. Some claim apparently to go back to 1200 before the Common Era. But clearly there is a shift, and it's a twofold shift. The first shift moves in a philosophical direction. That is to step back and ask, wait a minute, what is the meaning of all of these rituals? We hardly understand the Sanskrit words that we're reciting by memory anymore anyway. How much longer should we do this? Because it's starting to, we would have said in our language, it's starting to feel more like magic and less like real worship. That was the problem, for starts. So you get a great deal of very abstruse and technical philosophical thought beginning to arise as we can trace through the Upanishads, the kind of secondary level of sacred texts that arise during this period, philosophical reflection and speculation as to how these rituals work and what they might mean. That's one shift. As part of that shift already, Karen Armstrong, in her book, The Great Transformation, massive, and indeed, all of the books that deal with this whole issue seem to all run to 600, 700, 800 pages of massive and sometimes quite dense scholarly text. Armstrong paints a particular picture of rituals that had in the past been violent toward animals, agonizing sacrifices, sometimes a slow death, but also all too often spilling over into violent clashes between different sects or cults of Hinduism, of which there have always been many. It is said by the scholars that Hinduism can only be defined generally as what Indian people have thought and done over the centuries, to which the next sentence is appended, and they've done and thought just about everything. So it's difficult to know how to build a wall around Hinduism very much. But that one of the ancient commonalities, apparently having to do with the Aryan invasions or infiltrations, there's a lot of discussion on that now, into India, which had a great deal of violence associated with their worship. And so priests, indeed, of different sects and cults, different branches of thought, all coming out of the old background worship of ancient gods whose names hardly carry forward into the Hinduism we know today. Rudra, the roaring god of war, Agni, the god of fire, and others, won't take time for that, being resupplanted by different gods now. Rudra does carry forward as Shiva, but Shiva is a god of mixed attitude, both friendly toward humans, but also sometimes ferocious. There's a certain doubleness in his character. Vishnu and Brahma and Shakti Devi, the feminine aspect of the divine, always there, and so forth and so on. It continues down through what Hindus now tell us really amounts to 333 million. I haven't checked lately, but apparently that's quite enough gods even for the populous Southern Asia subcontinent. The result then is that somehow we have a shift not only of divinities, but of understandings represented by those divinities. As Armstrong traces it, the rituals were radically cut back, severely reduced, shortened, and simplified, and that sacrifice, animal sacrifice, was considerably curtailed, not totally eliminated, that the sacrifice of the animals involved was done off stage, off scene, rather than in the middle of the great drama, which ritual usually presents as an enacted myth, also cutting out opportunities for different clashes and groups of priests to get into squabbles with one another, which sometimes resulted in bloodshed, that this was a radical transformation of the consciousness over a period of a half a millennium in India. Wendy Doniger, in her massive study, The Hindus, nuances that picture a little bit, but even she, while she's more technically restrained, perhaps, than Karen Armstrong is, does say, nonetheless, that there was a great emerging ambivalence toward violence starting a few centuries before the time of Christ. And we do see this reflected. That's the first shift, the ritual simplification and removal of the violence. Alongside that, there is a second one, which moves toward a new kind of religious experience. It has a different character to it. It moves from philosophy and ritual followed by philosophy. It moves now toward the kind of popular devotional worship experience that in Hindi and in Sanskrit is called bhakti yoga. The name is not important, but it has much to do with similar to the praise music that we have in Christianity. But it's a clear shift reflected in popular religious literature, the Bhagavad Gita, the Mahabharata, the Ramayana, and other popular kind. It's democratizing of religious experience in ways that really shift the religion. So we see ritual being curtailed. We see an attempt to deal ethically with fellow humans and even toward animals. Today, there are only comparatively few temples in India where any sacrifice of animals takes place, greatly curtailed. And also at the same time, a devotional relationship of a one-to-one interaction with a chosen God. Choose one this lifetime, choose another one the next lifetime, and maybe eventually you work your way through the whole 333 million. But you get the idea of personal accountability to the divine, not unlike, in some ways, what we see the Hebrew prophets doing as well. I must go quickly. The rebel saint, Buddha himself, even overthrows any ritual at all, and again, even more severely curtails the sense of the self. Where Hinduism, here's where Buddhism and Hinduism came to a parting of the ways. Hinduism did come up with the formula that there is a spark of the divine in us. The Vedanta school led out in that. Buddha, we have to go very quickly, so I'll simply cut to the chase here, wound up taking the opposite tack and saying, actually, the whole idea of yourself is an illusion. The self turns into sand between your fingers and is simply a convenient kind of reference point, but there is no such thing as a self that's separately identifiable at all. Now, already, we begin to see sharp differences as well as similarities. The Buddha calls for ethics. The Buddha downplays ritual. The Buddha does relativize the idea of a self. And when you don't have a self, there's nothing to be selfish with, which is really where he was driving. That was his purpose in all of this. But at the same time, we begin to see now the questions emerging. And so let's... if you'll take it on faith from me, in the case of Confucius, again, he was born, 500 years before Christ, something like that, and into a situation in China of great upheaval. Chinese historians call it the time of the warring states. It was one of those chaotic periods of 200 or 300 years between dynasties when every little kingdom is trying to play king of the mountain and get on top of everybody else, and there's chaos on what the Chinese call great chaos under heaven. Happens periodically in Chinese society. Kung, Confucius, was born in such a situation and asked the question that everyone was asking. How do we get a decent society going again? And how do we keep ourselves from wiping ourselves off the face of the earth? For him, the only thing that he could turn to was the question of ritual as well. But in so doing, rather than destroying it or throwing it out the window, he repurposed it in very humanistic directions. He took the rituals which had always been oriented toward the emperor and toward the ancestors and said, well, basically, I don't know about the hereafter. I don't know about the ancestors. But I know that the rituals refine our spirit and make us more decent people, and that's reason enough to have them. But he was quite explicit. Funerals, he said, are not for the sake of the dead, they're for the sake of the living. The disciples asked him repeatedly about the hereafter, and he would say, I don't understand this life, and you want me to talk about the next one? Very agnostic. So again, we see here the same set of issues being bent in a different direction, but towards similar purposes. How do you get a humane and decent society going? How do we learn to take care of and look out for one another? Kung Fu's, Confucius' great principle there was simply ran, human-heartedness, an attitude of loving kindness toward one another. There's much more to say about that, but I must hasten onward quickly. Out of it all, however, comes a particular set of questions. Houston Smith and John Bowker, who has written a well-known and often used textbook in world religions today, Houston Smith has taken the position that we can at least hear voices suggesting that, here's the old metaphor, all religions take different pathways up the mountain, but when you climb a mountain, you reach the summit and they all meet together in some way. That's a definite maybe, but I think we need to think a little more about this. Karen Armstrong has taken a similar path when she asks, do we have here a formula for what we should do in the world, in the world, shrinking world in which we live? Is it possible that we have somehow one God behind all of this? Both of them, Armstrong and Smith, acknowledge the divergences and differences among world religions. They are neither one so naive as to try to, in some simplistic way, mush all religions together in one great syncretism. That doesn't work anyhow. But I would like to ask a little different question than they do. And it's one that arises out of my reading not only of them, but of Stephen Prothero, who has just brought out a book called God Is Not One, in which he takes issue with that and takes the idea that it's a little simplistic, that it flattens out the religions and the differences among the gods as well, and he pushes back in interesting and rather pungent ways at points. He names particularly Armstrong and Smith. Houston Smith, he says, focuses on the timeless ideals of what he calls our wisdom traditions and emphasizes the spiritual experience of it all. That the perennial philosophy that would claim that there is divine, there's one God somehow behind all of this, is a little too simple or simplistic as a way of coming at it. He goes on to spell out some of the difficulties with that. He says, unfortunately, we live in a world where religion seems as likely to detonate a bomb as to defuse one. He says, I understand what these people are doing. They are calling us toward a hope that will invoke in us feelings of brotherhood and sisterhood. And in the face of religious bigotry and bloodshed, we cannot help but be drawn to such a vision. And yet, we must see things for what they are. He says, we live in a world where religion seems as likely to detonate a bomb as to defuse one. So while we need idealism, we also need realism even more. We need to understand religious people as they are, not just at their best, but also at their worst. We need to look not only at their awe-inspiring architecture and their gentle mystics, but also at their suicide bombers. Yeah. So out of all of this then comes the question, is it Pollyanna? To say a pluribus unum applies to the divinities, to God and the gods, however you want to phrase it, as well as to us, their devotees and followers. And yet, in a way, when Prothero is pushing back against this, what he is really saying explicitly is that when we look at the teachings and preachments of these religions, we see that they are really quite different. And so they are. But if we shape the question in terms of those particular shifts that took place in the centuries before Jesus, and this is me speaking now, not Prothero, when we look at the question of the role of ritual, which moves people in and of itself toward kind of mechanical attitudes toward whatever divinities are the object of the ritual, reinforces and fosters clan consciousness and tribal thinking, when we see that shifting across the ancient empires that had little concourse with one another, when we see what I didn't mention, even around the Mediterranean world in the centuries before Christ, the rise of what scholars refer to as the Age of Anxiety, which reflects a new sense of self-awareness, of individual accountability to the gods. This is new. When we see the question of the self being engaged so sharply and critically by the great thinkers of the world's leading traditions, engaged in ways that, in one way or another, pull us outside of our individual selves, as well as outside of our tribal or clan groups or totemic groups or whatever they may be. When we see the golden rule cropping up again and again, in very similar language, yes, positive as well as negative. It is not only Christianity that has a positive formulation of the golden rule. The principle behind the positive and negative formations is the same principle. Cropping up again and again, whether it be in Confucianism, Hinduism, Taoism, which we haven't talked about. Once again, we have to ask ourselves that haunting question. Why these same issues? Why at this time period of 600 or 700 centuries, something like that, what's going on here? Do we really have to ask with Prothero the question whether God is somehow to be reduced to one particular divinity simply because we see such different pathways or even behaviors? Yes. This is not a Pollyanna question, and we do not have to be a sanguine, perhaps, as Armstrong particularly has been, and Houston Smith has been accused of being, although he is more subtle in his formulations. We need to ask ourselves whether the human race, at this particular watershed, this turning point, across much of the ancient map, had through whatever dynamic arrived at the place where they were ready to ask new questions, and that these have been questions that are central to the impact of religious experience in human life and which still remain with us still today. Now, if we want to go beyond that, sure, we can posit the issue of whether there are one God or many gods. Let us hear the conclusion of Prothero's argument. He says, when it comes to safeguarding the world from the evils of religion, including violence by proxy from the hand of God, the claim that all religions are one is no more effective than the claim that all religions are poison. And we've seen that too in atheistic philosophical writings from Sam Harris to Christopher Hitchens and their ilk, as you know. Far more powerful, he says, is the reminder that any genuine belief in what we call God should humble us, remind us that if there really is a god or goddess worthy of the name, he or she or it must surely know more than we do about the things that matter most. This much, at least, he says, is shared across the great religions, his final words. But Professor Prothero tried to ask him this at AAR meeting this November, American Academy of Religion. But there were so many other people pressing around, it was hard for him to engage me in thoughtful reflection on this. We need to invite him to La Sierra sometime, I think, to help reflect with us on this. It's not simply the question, really, of whether we can somehow posit that there must be one God in the sense that all peoples must understand that God in the same way. I think that's asking too much, indeed, asking the wrong question. But is it nonetheless possible that we have evidence of a divine hand, each people being led and engaged in terms meaningful to their own culture, their own society, their own tradition, their own presuppositions, their own idols and ideas and struggles? to ask fresh questions about ritual, about self, about community, about neighbor, about golden rule? Do we have to have one God who is conceived in the same terms across all these cultures in order to posit that simple thing? Prothero is a scholar and rightly reserves himself from speculating on the divine, about which we do not speculate in academic circles unless we are in theological seminaries. We tend to do it there. But Prothero knows better than to get caught up in that. So he simply skirts that issue. But it seemeth me that we are really thrown back upon that middle ground that the early church arrived at in the face of the questions raised in its infancy by Marcion, who wanted to say, no, they are two gods, the God of the Old Testament, the Hebrew God, and the God of the Christians. They cannot possibly be the same. They are too different. The church took up that challenge and came out saying, no, that is one God, no matter how different. This was not to mush Hebrew tradition, Judaism, and Christianity into one syncretistic ball of wax. The church did not do that either. But between the two extremes of alienation, between the two understandings of God, on the one hand, and an absolute separation, or a simple kind of conflation of all ideas of God, and on the other hand, into one picture, the church found a middle ground that could indeed say, there is one God, and we see that God at work variously, as Hebrew says, in diverse times and places. Various peoples in terms meaningful to their cultural context and their understanding. We do not have to have a uniform understanding of God, it seems to me, in order to posit a single divine hand. Yes, maybe even guiding a certain evolution. None of this has really cooked itself out yet. It's an extremely lively conversation. It is very vigorously engaged on various sides today. John Bowker, whose name I mentioned a moment ago, really takes up the cudgels alongside Prothero to protest against this idea of what they call the perennialists, that there is one great philosophy and one great God to be understood similarly across the board. And of course, in those terms, they are right. But when we as Adventists think about God and that divine hand that Ellen White has pointed us to behind the stage, you know, above and behind human affairs, leading and guiding, we find for ourselves the possibility of a peek behind the curtain, maybe, after all. I invite your reflections that we think together about this afternoon. Thank you for your patience with this.
Questions. What's Prothero's academic discipline?
Religious studies. He's on the he's on the faculty of the Boston University, and has traveled widely, adventured much, listened to people of all faiths. Religious studies professor. By religious studies, I mean generic religious studies, not necessarily Christianity as such.
Toward the end of your talk, you suggested the possibility of a position that God is, you know, whatever we conceive him behind there, is working to minister to different cultures in terms of their paradigms and history and so on they have, and hopefully his wisdom. I guess that raises the next question. Is one religion doing a service to another group when they try to take people, to impose their understanding to a group that has a different heritage and would not get the same benefits from it, but is benefiting from their customized version, if you will?
Yeah.
It's a kind of a simple, crude
simplification. No, 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 the motive for mission, in a way. Let me pick up on a couple aspects of that. We certainly do a disservice to one another when we kind of, when any religious group reduces the other to people simply who are on our pathway but not as far down it as we are. And Hindus do that too. Ramakrishna was a good example of this about a century or so ago. Behind the whole Bhaktivedanta movement, which is big in the United States now. These are the people you see dancing in circles in airport lobbies and so forth. They too say, there's one God, and you Christians are on the same pathway. But they mean that in Hindu terms. Much as Karl Rahner, flipping it over, said that all non-Christians are anonymous Christians. That is to say, someday they're going to get there. That is the first wrong pathway about that. Second wrong pathway, of course, is to evangelize in our terms, not in other people's terms. There's the old joke about the evangelical Christian missionary guy, young guy, aggressive, who's talking with his young Hindu friend over in India and simply says to him, "You must be born again." To which the Hindu replies in exasperation, "I have been again and again and again." You get the idea. So language shifts at that point, and that's a mistake also, isn't it? But somewhere in all of that, the motive for mission remains when it is, I think, a simple and humble sharing two ways. After all, the good Lord gave us twice as many ears as mouths, and I think we're called upon to listen at least twice as much as we speak. I have done evangelism with full conviction, and happy to continue to, when it is a humble sharing for what I see as a particular blessings that come out of the particular pathway to which I've been called to walk, but at the same time, a genuine readiness to learn from others. And when I take my students on field trips in the Inland Empire, where we are graced with wonderful opportunities to visit worship centers of many faiths, I think we're able to do that in a way that the students understand is a chance to learn, but I've never had one of them convert to any of these other faiths yet. And so I think rather they still take joy in the goodnesses of their Adventist Christian heritage. We celebrate that. Does that help a little bit anyway? Yeah.
Some world religions have created new civilizations. I think Christianity and Islam have new cultures. Others canonize the status quo. Is that a legitimate classification? I think of Confucianism, for example, of the latter.
I'm thinking of it too, as you ask, how different the situation in China from Korea was, you know.
The actual age, the time frame that you outlined for that excluded the two biggest religions, Christianity and Islam. Mm-hmm. How do you relate to that?
Yeah. First of all, a quick reflection on your thoughtful and perceptive question. Yeah, Confucianism does not establish a new civilization or civilization, I'll use your word, in China. It certainly came as one to Korea that way and overrode the old shamanic traditions in ways that have been very pronounced still to this day, as we see with our Presbyterian and Methodist friends. So your first question is that a legitimate classification? I think only with specific reference to a given context can we ask that question, not as an absolute. Christianity, by some Axial Age scholars, Jesus, is enrolled as the tail end of this period, particularly because he was the summative voice, but not the founding voice, of that shift among the prophets with whom Jesus identified himself so clearly. As you know, the ritual considerations yielded to considerations of love for Jesus, love to God, love to fellow man. The rest was allowed to fall by the wayside. Now, given that, Jesus is not a formative voice, but he is certainly the culminating voice in that great prophetic movement. Jesus identified himself with the prophets in those terms. So I think in a certain sense, we can certainly include him in that. Interestingly enough, Carl Jaspers wrote a book, it's excerpted from his philosophy volume 1, where he takes up the case of Socrates, Buddha, Confucius, and Jesus. And he's clearly taking them up separately, each in their own context, but as part of that great watershed. And he sees just Jesus as part of it. Yeah. Yes. Islam, it's a half a millennium later that the Arabic peoples, I think under the influence of the fact that Mecca was a crossroads of so many trading groups, 360-some idols around them, the Kaaba, as you know, they were exposed to many, many cultural currents and influences and ideas. And so finally, I think, they were ripe for a message that would say, stop burying your girl babies alive, yeah, and the things that you were doing, and take up personal accountability to the all-merciful, the compassionate one, Allah. That was a new message for them. But they were ripe for it when it came, but it was slower in coming. And I think came from outside. I think it came from outside because they were at a crossroads of trading caravans who already were keenly aware of those shifts from centuries earlier. Good, thoughtful question, Bob. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate your presentation, and I'm very much aware that we do live in this global society where we are facing different cultures. If I may use that term, maybe more specific is we are facing different worldviews. Now, when we come to worldviews, we are coming down to very fundamental assumptions and presuppositions that humans take as they are trying to answer the very important questions of life. And I have a problem here with this way, this line of thinking here. We assume Pratero, Armstrong, Smith, all these authors assume that divinity or God or gods or someone is behind all of these developments. How about if we start thinking that these religions, which are nothing else but a set of beliefs that humans and set of ideas, set of answers that humans come up with as they are trying to answer the fundamental questions of life. And religions are basically human ways to answer their problem, human predicament in which we find ourselves. And therefore, all of these religions are basically human inventions. To me, I think there is too much made out of this axial age. There are other ways to explain why is mm-hmm. this happening. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be that, okay, some divine force is behind mm-hmm. and trying to work among all these mm-hmm. different peoples. Mm-hmm. The beauty of Judea, Hebrew tradition is that we are told in the scripture that this is not human invention. This is a revelation that comes from the outside of creation and mm-hmm. tells us the reality. Mm-hmm. And now, for me, I cannot see Hebrew prophets. I cannot put Hebrew prophets, starting with Moses and ending with the apostles, in the same category mm-hmm. as Plato, Buddha, mm-hmm. Zoroaster, mm-hmm. Confucius, mm-hmm. and all these great thinkers of the mm-hmm. past. Mm-hmm. We have completely different assumptions here where we start.
Yeah, thank you. Forgive me. Yes, thank you for a thoughtful question. May I accept your question with a little bit of nuancing, but it's a carefully thought out question. First of all, you understand, of course, I think you understand that I am not here to advocate one or another of these positions, but to lay out the discourse for us and sharpen our own thinking as to where it stands today. Secondly, We need to be clear that neither Prothero nor Smith nor Armstrong are positing a divine God behind the process. Now, Prothero kind of accuses Armstrong and Smith of doing that, but they aren't. Neither Houston Smith in his textbook nor Armstrong does that. They simply trace the events coldly and baldly on the page. Now, Armstrong gets a little more preachy at points about the thing, but she does not speculate about a God or the gods behind it as such. Beyond that, I would simply want to suggest that the uniqueness of the Hebrew prophets is their uniqueness on their own level, even as the uniqueness of Buddha is his and the uniqueness of Confucius is his, and so forth, because they each, in their own way, can speak of the divine influence. Now, the scholars don't necessarily buy that, but even Hinduism begins with the distinction of the Vedas from the Upanishads, the Vedas as that which was handed down and heard from the divinities, from gods, versus the Upanishads, which were memorized and human inventions, to be sure. Yeah, they too claim the divine forces revealed the Vedic meanings and texts to them. Buddha does not make that claim because he doesn't have a divine to which to attribute it, but certainly Confucius, for all of his humanism, speaks repeatedly, if only in passing, of the will of heaven. And there's a sense that he is exploring the ways in which heaven's desire for the human race are to be drawn out and expressed in our lives. It's difficult then when we have these various traditions claiming on one level or another some sort of divine guidance and revelation, rather than simply claiming that only the Hebrew prophets made that assertion for themselves. It is simply not true. In a way, that relativizes the question for us, doesn't it? Think again of Muhammad, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. Would you like to follow up on that?
No, I think it will take us too far and too much into discussion. There are other
ones. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Please.
I find your presentation that behind all of human societies, everywhere, there's this sense of the divine, the other. I can remember the shocks in my experience as I went as a missionary almost 60 years ago. I thought I knew exactly what to teach, but then this other world appears.
Yeah.
And with the help of an anthropologist who helped me and instructed me, I was staggered. As a matter of fact, I began to feel that I was secular, contrast to that world in which they lived.
Yeah.
And talking to him about this, he said it has staggered anthropologists wherever they have studied that there is this sense of the divine. Mm-hmm. Now, and you have presented this very powerfully, but I'm oversimplifying. But now, I heard a speech by Oz Guinness, not very recently, and which he said, we are now entering a new stage. For the first time now in the late 20th century, we are getting an utterly secular society.
Yes.
And he raised the question, but he didn't really answer it. How are we going to respond to this? Mm-hmm. Is Mark Knowles' most recent book, Jesus Christ and the Life of the Mind, is this the way to face it? But this is a challenge to all of us and a different question.
Oh, you're referring to the scandal of the evangelical mind?
No, that's
earlier. Laying down the sword.
But now he's written a book on Jesus Christ and the life of the mind.
Yes.
The life of the mind. And he puts the incarnation. Here is a reality that is central to our thought.
Thank you. Good question. What I the question sets itself up out of the thoroughgoing secularization of our society. Yes. The scholars, the anthropologists are blown away by the spiritual experience of people wherever they go, Pacific Islands, Africa, wherever. It's the scholars who step back and ask the relativizing and humanistic question, can this and this and this religious tradition be taken as a human invention? Starting with Nietzsche, God created us in his image and we return the favor. Yeah. But it seems to me that the scholars, academicians such as Prothero, Balcker, and others, fall silent appropriately and legitimately before the ultimate question of God, and yet they still have to wrestle with the evidences, evidences of the sort we've adduced all too briefly this afternoon. Now, we have to say to every secularist, it seems to me, how would you help me understand this phenomenon, not plural, this phenomenon at a particular time and half millennium or so of human history of dawning awareness and rising concern, which triggered different answers in different societies, but nonetheless circles around the same questions? That, to me, is really the interesting question. And I think it's interesting because it also has to engage secularists. Does that help a little? Yeah, thank you.
I'm interested in this, I'll call it hypothesis, that perhaps God's hand is moving in common amongst these different religions at the same time in Earth's history. And yet, you see, you know, even up to the modern era, other groups or entities, maybe primitive tribal religions and so on, so-called primitive, where you don't see that movement has taken place. So, first of all, you're saying that God was sort of selective, perhaps, in where he acted. But what I want to get to is, so if you go beyond that hypothesis and you say, what other sociological or other factors could have arisen at the same time throughout various regions of the world that would have driven this same sort of trend within these different religions, what would those be? For example, from a technology standpoint, we see in agriculture the role of the plow, the horse collar, et cetera, to revolutionize agriculture and thereby to enable large cities to be built, which in turn change sociologically cultures to become less tribal, develop monarchies, et cetera. And so as the way people live changes, wouldn't that induce a necessary change in religion? For example, from a more violent religion to a more cooperative and peaceful trend, some of the trends that you've alluded to. So are there some other factors outside of this sort of God question that would drive these same sorts of religious changes that perhaps these authors have identified?
Good, thank you. Let me take it up quickly in the order that you did. You're right. We see little, if any, evidence among the Aztecs, or particularly the Aztecs, for this kind of shift. Now, among the Inca, maybe, but they're still playing with that one. So your thesis, your predication is correct. It's not everywhere in all times and places at the same historic juncture. So far, all I've been able to find, and I've tried to look into this question a bit of converging or common triggers that might foster such a shift of consciousness, there are, it looks like, maybe two. And whether these are adequate or not really goes to the heart of the question of whether we have any divine intentionality behind this. The first one is the one you cited between nomads and settled agriculturalists. Does that generate the conditions for this kind of shift? Perhaps away from violence, although again, the Aztecs had been settled for a long time, and boy, were they ever violent, you know, both in warfare with neighboring groups but against humans generally, as you know. The other already is close to that. It is posited that all of these great thinkers were at a time of great upheaval, social, political, triggered by conflict and combat. And that's about the only other kind of common element we can find so far. Now, there have been plenty of other periods like that in human history that seem not to have converged in quite this way, so it's still got the scholars scratching their heads over this, but those are the two factors that they are digging into right now in an attempt to try to come up with more. That's more of a report and less of an answer, but you get the idea. Yeah.
Yeah, hi, John.
Yeah, thank you, John. Just a comment, and then maybe just a couple of questions. I remember, this is about Houston Smith, a few AAR meetings back when Houston Smith had a plenary session, and he, I think, really set the whole place ablaze with his openness. You're speaking now of perhaps a hand, a divine, or something, or some intelligence, when he was actually open to Michael Behe. Open to Michael Behe. And that said, everybody was reeling. And so one wonders what he, you know, is that his way of maybe saying there's something behind? So that's one thing. Another thing is then, in what sense should we or should we not think of a divine hand? Is there a demonic hand? How do we think of that? And then maybe in conjunction with that, and finally, what are your thoughts on the emerging church movement?
Yeah. Thank you, John. I come over here only for the sake of the recording. Houston Smith always has forever identified himself as Christian. He was raised as a son of Christian missionaries in inland China. A complete immersion to the other, which impacted his psyche deeply, profoundly. Yeah, understand that. Perhaps he is more guarded in what he has written in his books than what he was saying in AAR at the plenary address. I don't know. He and I are both vegetarians, and so by dint of that, we have wound up in the same restaurants together and had a couple of talks over lunch over a couple or 3 years. Because we're looking for the same food. but I don't know. I've asked him why Christianity, and he said, it's simply my home. It's simply my home. And by that, he is too deep a thinker to say simply, I'm a cultural Christian. Not at all. He has thought this through, and it simply holds water for him in ways that the others don't. But he says, I reserve the right to inform and enrich my Christianity with those aspects of other religions that do inform and enrich without twisting it theologically. And I asked him to give me a couple of examples, and he did so that I think were quite illustrative and helpful, but we can talk about more personally if you like afterwards. Now, your last question was about emerging church, but in between you sandwich the issue of
demonic hand.
Oh, yeah. Well, John, we each have to ask and answer that question in our own way and for ourselves. Me, I can only ask and answer that question, and fasten your seatbelts on this one. I have not taken a stance on these issues that I'm sharing with you. But I will say this. From within my own pilgrimage of faith, I think you can only ask that question if you're willing to posit the demonic in religions generally or only in other religions. Does the question mean that I see the demonic forces at work in non-Christian religions, and if so, only? Or does that open up the potential for the demonic to exercise influences through and across all the religious spectrum, including my own. And so I have to look very humbly at that question. The emerging church movement, maybe that's another forum sometime.
I would like to ask you to look into the crystal ball and prophesy. Do you think that maybe we are now living in another axial age in which we are seeing a new revolution in the way in which we understand ourselves in terms of globalization, in terms of our new understanding of freedom, which certainly takes away from religion something which was characteristic in terms of divine sovereignty over the world and everything else. And then also the very fact that we are talking like we are talking here. I mean, this dialogue, this kind of conversation could not have taken place too long ago. So the very fact that we are involved right now in this kind of conversation and we are trying to understand ourselves vis-a-vis other religions may produce a new actual age in which we move into a totally different religious situation.
Or can we have our own quite apart from what other faiths are doing as well? You ask me, I'll try
to
make
say the nuclear
brief.
Age.
Yeah,
right.
What
does that add
yeah.
to the?
Yeah, right.
To our age?
I'll try to be succinct here because I know the clock is ticking out on us now. I try to have mercy on you. Of course, you're not really asking me to be a prophet because you know I'm not one. But I can try to be a canary. My Welsh ancestors, who drudged out their lives below ground in Welsh coal mines, as you know, would take canaries into the mines with them. And interestingly enough, it was usually the canaries who paid the price first if there was poisonous gas around, which puts me in an interesting position, but I'll be a canary. It's been said by church historians that about every 500 years, the Christian church has had a great garage sale and has kind of gone through and sorted through and rummaged through things and kind of let go of certain things that no longer hold water, you know, and other things are retained. In which case, if we look back, we find just simply in sheer calendrical terms that we may very well be on the edge of such a watershed experience. If I hear my students correctly and listen to them thoughtfully and perceptively, I also have to wonder if there is not evidence that in their lifetimes, perhaps not mine, that we will see clear contours emerging in new terms about what it is to love God and love our neighbor in relation to the 27, nay 28 fundamental beliefs, in relationship to the rituals and the ceremonial aspects and all the rest that goes up to make up a mature and ripened, well-developed faith, faith tradition, I should say. Are we at the point where the tradition is coming to ask of us again a step back and at least perhaps a ranking in some ways of the 27, nay, now 28 and counting, of these tenets on which our faith, around which our faith is structured. Yes, I think there is a very real possibility and that the contours could begin to emerge during the lifetimes of our students. Yeah.
Okay, I think we'll take our last question over here,
okay.
John.
Yeah.
Okay, just as context, I'm a believer in the great controversy between good and evil. And I think that if we were to do a pie chart of all beliefs,
systems, that secularism would have a place along with the various religions. Within that context, I see secularism as a religion with a small r. I'm going to read the question because it's fairly long. I don't want to miss anything. Is it possible that the differences that you have been pointing out in various religions, but having a common core, could be termed as a culture? And if so, could it be that while God would like to manage the church, that the adversary, the devil, is managing the culture, and that that culture is a vehicle that he uses to access us?
It is not possible that this represents a culture. It is possible, and indeed I think true, that each of these great faith traditions represents highly divergent and very different cultures from one another. But then, of course, I'm left with the twofold question. Is it possible that evil uses that to communicate with us, but that at the same time, so does God? In other words, do we need to divorce the divine or the satanic from culture at either end of the equation?
I see that God, through the Holy Spirit, accesses our mind directly, and the devil is restricted to accessing us through our culture, and even further restricted through our negative emotions.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I don't see the devil as anywhere on an equal platform.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In fact, I think he's incredibly crippled. And intuitively, meanwhile, we're following him still, probably for the same reason that we may tend to be beguiled, mm-hmm. like even was in mm-hmm. the
mm-hmm. Good. I'll take that as a faith statement, which I will salute. Thank you.
Yeah. Don't you feel sorry that Professor Jones has to leave us and fly to sunny Southern California and not enjoy this wonderful weather? But in spite of that, let's thank him for his presence.